of the folk music scene that I know from Pete Seeger. It's a story about the song We Shall Overcome. Where does that come from? Well, Seeger has a book called Where Have All the Flowers Gone, where he tells this story. What do we know about its origins? 1903, there's a published song by a guy named Reverend Charles Tindley. This is all in my book, by the way, those of you who are madly taking notes. You'll be on August 17th, you'll find a printed version. Tindley writes and prints a song. He's a black minister from Philadelphia. A song called I'll Overcome Someday has the refrain line, if in my heart I do not yield, I'll overcome someday. Then there's also a folk song, I'll Be All Right, which has a similar refrain line, deep in my heart I do believe I will be all right someday. So these were known hymns and songs. Then in the 1940s, you find this is in the historical record, there's a garment worker strike in South Carolina, and a woman shows up on the picket line singing one of these songs, only differently, slowing it down. And this then goes to the Highlander Folk School, which was, as you know, a kind of center for radical organizing. And that's where Seeger learns it, and a bunch of other people. And they in each of these cases, the rhythm changes, the words change, and finally it ends up as We Shall, well, actually it's first published as We Will Overcome in 1947 in the People's Songs, which you can find a photocopy of in the music library here. But the burden of this story is there comes a moment around 1960 when this has become the movement song. Everybody's singing it. And the Weavers record it and so forth. Seeger says, well, his friends came to him and he says, you know, if we don't copyright this song, what's going to happen is somebody in Tin Pan Alley or Hollywood is going to take it and write, you know, Honey, Baby, We'll Overcome Tonight or something. And get a copyright on it. And Seeger says, look, what's, you know, things which our social system leaves unowned tend to be mistreated. Look what's happened to the air and the water. So what Seeger and four other people did was they took a copyright on this song. We Shall Overcome is copyrighted. But they signed a songwriter's contract that declared all royalties and income from this song will go to a nonprofit fund which annually gives grants to further African-American music in the South. Whenever Seeger publishes the song, the copyright notice says, royalties derived from this composition are being contributed to the We Shall Overcome Fund under the trusteeship of the writers. So, I tell this story because, first of all, it's interesting. It's a little weird. You have to wonder, how does this play out in time? What happens if the trustees die? You know, it's not clear if this has been fully thought out, but I think it isn't a good example of somebody feeling, look, my obligations here are to this civil rights movement, not to myself. And that's where this song comes from, and somehow we want to keep it in the community that created it and use it to support the community and so forth. It's the early example of what many people know about, which is the general public license. So I won't go into this at length because my assumption is that many people in this audience know about it, but you end up in the early 80s, when software people have a similar problem of collaborative software being taken private and trying to figure out some way to manage this collectively owned resource such that the commonality of it is preserved. And as you know, the GPL allows you to A, copyright something, but then B, release it under a license that lets other people downstream use it under the terms that you have established. So to come back to this question of how, if you have a commons that you want to protect, how might individuals do it? And in both of these cases, it seems to me what I'm describing is like Sandel's sense of a duty that arises from your sense of belonging to this community that then gets turned into, well, first, I think it begins in both cases with a norm, with some sense that this is how we behave in this community, but then later it gets turned into this legal protocol of a kind of claim and release in which you use the law as a lever to both own something but then set the terms of ownership. This package, by the way, it typically gets called in the popular press, this is the copyleft alternative to copyright, a term I hate, because the correlative of a right, which is what you have in copyright, is a duty. And so I think of these as copy duty laws. The GPL is an example of copy duty. And in fact, it fits nicely with the origins of the word common. Some people think this word comes out of Latin com, meaning together, and munus, meaning under obligation, or munia, meaning duties. So the word itself has this sense of having some common duty in it from which you might develop your norms or, if you need to, your laws. So this is one simple idea, that you have a sense of duty and you try to figure out how to operationalize it. I said I was going to work from individuals to communities. So let me move to this second stage and say that the thing that most influenced me thinking about this is an old book of Michael Walzer's called Spheres of Justice. So what Walzer says in this book is, gosh, we live in a world of a really complex social institutions which are different from one another. So the military is not the same as the college, and the college is not the same as the judiciary, and these are different from churches, and these are different from families. These are all spheres of social life, internal to which you may find norms and ways of behaving and understanding which help them operate, but which will differ from sphere to sphere. And Walzer's sort of simple thesis, which he takes from a wonderful passage of Pascal's, which is in the book, is a definition of tyranny, and that tyranny is the domination of one sphere by another. So that if you get the military dominating the marketplace, or the marketplace dominating the Congress, or whatever, anything that leaks from one sphere to another, it's a simple form of tyranny. And we have names of these. Aristocracy is a form of social life in which aristocrats, people whose identity comes from lineage and from family, get to then also be in charge of the parliament or the church or whatever. Or you have theocracy, in which people whose identity is the church get to control the marketplace. Or you have meritocracy, in which people like ourselves who have higher degrees get to decide, other stuff. And Walzer's point is these are tyrannous if you go outside of your own realm. And so this is raising an interesting question about cultural commons. The problem being that a form of encroachment on the commons will be these cases in which one sphere of social life dominates another. And the most egregious examples that we know in recent times are, I think, places where, for example, biotechnology, which has its own system of inquiry and ownership and so forth, begins to dominate something else. Or the entertainment industry, which begins to dominate something else. And just to say a bit about the entertainment industry, my favorite, I would say in a certain sense, the rules that the entertainment industry would like to have run its businesses are appropriate to the entertainment industry. Those FBI warnings that you get when you put your DVD in the slot are entertainment industry warnings, but the problem is when they leak out. And of course, the way they've leaked out, I mentioned copyright term extension, and this is famously called the Sony Bono Copyright Term Extension Act. But I don't think it's a mistake to notice that it was the entertainment industry's congressman who's here you have a case in which a particular industry has tremendous sway over the legislative process in this country, such that the laws of the nation begin to represent the norms of that sphere of social life, and then get exported such that colleges and universities are asked to operate under, all these three things that line up. And the sort of poster child of the success of this is 2006, a letter that the University of Southern California's Deputy Chief Information Officer sent to all incoming freshmen, telling them not only, of course, that they shouldn't engage in illegal file sharing, but saying that the university's purpose is to promote and foster the creation of lawful intellectual property. So this is a very peculiar definition of what university's purpose is. And but at the University of Southern California, this is what an incoming freshman is told. So this is complete coordination between the ethics of the entertainment industry and those of a college. I mean, a contrary example, just to give you a moment of hope, this stuff keeps coming up, and in fact, I think it's it's the endless wave that is butts up against colleges and universities in this country, because people, the industries keep going to Congress and asking them to change the rules, and what they would really like to have is filtering systems put onto all college networks such that they can find students who are doing bad things. And I found a letter from Gerald Grochow, is that how his name is pronounced, who is the chief information officer at MIT, during one of these fights in which Congress is trying to do this. And he says, file sharing occurs on an ongoing basis in the scientific research process, and sharing large data sets with colleagues across campus and across the country has become a cornerstone of academic research. He says at MIT, they have clear norms in which they tell the students what they should and shouldn't do, but filtering the network is simply not an acceptable option. Even if deterrent mechanisms are developed that do not disrupt legitimate file sharing, the proposed software deterrents we have reviewed are not able to scan our network sufficient at the bit rate at which a research-intensive university network such as ours has to operate. So, this goes on, but I mean, the point is, this is an example of somebody saying, beating the bounds, of somebody saying, we have a knowledge commons that operates under certain assumptions here at MIT, and for it to work, we can't change the rules the way you would like us to do it. All right, so I've, in a sense, said two things. One is this business coming a little bit out of Sandel, sense of duty, individuals trying to surface the norms by which they operate and make them stinting their commons. And secondly, institutions or spheres of social life doing the same thing. I want to talk a little now about a third piece of this, which is to think about the spaces that lie between spheres of social life. How does a college or university have a conversation with the entertainment industry and with the Congress about things if their values differ? Rather than have sort of siloed, discrete universes of social practice, how can we have conversation really where we disagree, but somehow entertain, perhaps even enjoy these disagreements and find some way to communicate? So I'm interested in spaces that I think of as the common carriers. So this common carrier is a legal term of art that refers to like railroads that have to let anybody who's bought a ticket ride. Those are common carriers. But I think of it in a more broad sense as all these interstitial institutions or media or fora that allow for public conversation. And how should we think of the durability of these? In the book, actually, I go back to, there was a wonderful moment in the 18th century when a preacher came to Philadelphia, and the local churches wouldn't let him preach there. And Franklin and his friends built a building, the assumption of which was anybody could come here and speak. And he says, even if the Mufti of Constantinople would like to come and preach to the citizens of Philadelphia, he will have a platform. And it's an interesting image because, to my mind, it's not exactly about freedom of speech. That is, it's about freedom of listening. Because you, as a member of the audience in such a hall, Sure, the hall authorizes the speakers to come and speak. They have that freedom, but it's more for the citizens of Philadelphia. The members of the audience get to hear conflicting voices, get to hear all the Protestant sects and even the Mufti of Constantinople, so that you might hear discordant narratives and have to figure out what the truth is. This is the kind of interstitial space I'm thinking of. And the problem is, how do you control such an interstitial space? And actually, in Franklin's case, what they did was to make a board of directors that had people from every different sect they could find in Philadelphia, so that nobody had control. They had to agree. But more broadly, I ended up thinking for myself that what's of interest in that image, and then more generally about governing such spaces, what I now am flipping the phrase and think of as carrier commons, was the idea of divided sovereignty. So just to give you a little history, when they were writing the Constitution, when they were figuring out how to run this nation in the 18th century, this was a completely novel idea. The whole idea of sovereignty was that you would have a unitary sovereign. It didn't make any sense that you would have multiple sovereigns. But then the problem was the founders were excessively cautious about power. They believed men in high stations increased their ambition and study rather to be more powerful than wiser or better, voracious like the grave. They can never have enough of power and wealth. The love of power is whetted, not cloyed by possession. I mean, there's a lot of rhetoric about this, that once you give somebody power, good luck in having them become a benevolent despot. So the idea of dividing sovereignty was had a lot of appeal. Let's just not give anybody such sovereignty. Actually, Moore mentioned that John Adams's papers are in this city, and including his notes from classes at Harvard and his books. So Adams learned about Newton as an undergraduate at Harvard, and one of the things that stayed with him was Newton's sense of the balance of powers in the Constitution is a Newtonian image of a stable system that has multiple centers, and Adams gets it out of Newton. Anyway, they were interested in dividing sovereignty. And one thing to fold into this, one thing that happened in England was that in the century before was that the Roman and Greek classics had finally come into English translation so that they were popularly read. And it had a great influence on English political theory. And in particular, in the Roman Digest of Laws, there's a distinction asserted that all of us are either free or slave. There's no middle category. And that slavery is not literal slavery, chattel slavery. Slavery is the situation in which somebody always has the power to trump your decision. That there's somebody out there who has a coercive power over you, even if it's a benevolent person. This is Quentin Skinner who writes about this. He says, to enjoy liberty is not sufficient to be free from coercion or the threat of it. It is necessary to be free from the possibility of being threatened or coerced. There's a lot of rhetoric in the early days about, Englishmen being turned into slaves, and it does not mean slavery in the later sense. It means this. So then a second piece of this is, one of the big fights they had was over the king in England's claim that he had what was called negative voice. And negative voice is essentially a veto power. It means that no matter what laws are passed by Parliament, the king can veto them. And if that is the case, then all English subjects are slaves under this logic. And negative voice would be an example of unitary sovereignty. I believe that this is one thing I do in the book is to show that as the founders begin to think about the circulation of knowledge and particularly about putting things into the Constitution that allow Congress to control, to give copyrights and patents and so forth, their history taught them that these institutions, copyright and patent, were forms of monopoly privilege. That in the earlier centuries, the crown had controlled the press and controlled a lot of other things by giving monopoly privileges to certain select people. It's a wonderful way to curry favor. And that this was abuse of royal power. And there was a long history of fighting the crown over monopolies. And in fact, there's a statute against monopolies, which exempts patents. It says you can have a 14-year monopoly, but it's interesting because it makes it clear that patent was understood as to be a monopoly because it has to be written into the statute against monopolies as an exception. And not only that, but it's also understood as a privilege. That is to say, these are not natural rights. The founders did not believe, with the possible exception of Noah Webster, that you have a natural right to a created thing. That when you write a poem or sing a song or write a political pamphlet, you have no natural right to its ownership. These are state-given privileges, maybe given for good reason, but nonetheless they are that. And they are also monopolies. And the monopolies have to be carefully controlled, partly because they are a form of negative voice. If somebody has a monopoly power over some piece of expression, they can stop you from using it, right? And okay, so that's and actually in the you know, the Sonny Bono Copyright Term Extension Act finally goes to the Supreme Court and gets turned back. Oh, is it 2-7? But at any rate, Stevens and Breyer both write dissents. And one nice thing in Justice Breyer's dissent was he makes a connection between the idea of limited monarchy and the limited monopoly privilege. And he does it, well, he says, it is well established that copyright must serve public, not private ends. And he pauses to note that Samuel Johnson's dictionary, the one the founders would have known, illustrated its definition of limited with the phrase a limited monarch, meaning a monarch restrained and circumscribed and not left at large. So it's a nice jump. That word is in the constitutional language about copyright. The Congress is allowed to give limited privileges to inventors and writers. But the word limited is there. And Breyer is saying they're using it the same way they would use the word limited in the phrase limited monarch, and for the same reason, that an unlimited monarch and an unlimited monopoly privilege are tyrannous. They are potentially suppressive of expression or other liberties. And you know, in terms of stinting the commons, what you would say is, okay, in this tradition that the founders inherited from Roman law and so forth, if in democratic practice, if democratic practice depends on plural speech and plural listening, then we should rightly be reluctant to give any modern form of negative voice a presence in the public sphere. And actually, in the book, I have a long list of examples I collected while doing this book of places where the copyright law has been used to suppress speech. And, you know, it happens all the time. I only give you two. One of them is in honor of Harry Lewis, who's here because when Harry and his friends did Blown to Bits, this is the title, right? Yeah, they had a screen grab of the posting of Lawrence Summers' remarks about women in science. So he gives these remarks, they put it up on the Happy Day, President Summers says this, and then, of course, this storm erupted, and they took him down. So they wanted to post, you know, the earlier version, the screen grab of Lawrence's actual remarks. And Summers's, and they were denied permission. You assume to protect poor Larry Summers from embarrassment. Now, you could say they, of course, have a fair use right to this. They could print this and go to court and defend it under the fair use statute and probably win. The two fair use cases that I document in the book that went through that process cost $125,000 to $250,000. So, you know, you gotta wanna be, yeah, exactly. You have to also get the publisher to say, could you escrow that amount in the unhappy case that we lose? So, I mean, and the other one, just in case you think this is about lefties, in 2008, presidential campaign, news organizations, including Fox, CBS, demanded John McCain commercials be removed from YouTube because they infringed the organization's copyrights. I mean, it's nuts. You know, McCain did public stuff on TV, on Fox, and so forth, and then uses the thing in his own. This is precisely, you know, the political speech that the founders intended the whole system to enable. And Fox and CBS were able to get DMCA takedown notices to stop these guys. And of course, during a political campaign, you don't have time to, you know, a week is a significant amount of time. So, I mean, there's 1,000 examples of this. Now, we started about 6 minutes late. We like, what do we do? Stop at 2? I have some summary remarks about. Okay, well, we'd like some discussion, but let me quickly say, in terms of, you know, my opening question was, suppose you have a public domain which seems poorly guarded and you want to turn it into a cultural commons, what are you going to do? And in a certain sense, I've, you know, buried in this is already some of my answers. The first is there are legal ways to do this, to say this matters and let's have some laws to do it. And this, the system of claim and release protocols that sort of in unformed form in the Seeger example and well-formed in the general public license. And then this is what, you know, then turns into the Creative Commons system that I think is a wonderful innovation to give people a chance to, yes, own their work, but at the same time say, look, you know, I'm an academic. I don't really care to make money here. I just want my ideas out there, and I release it under the, or whatever your terms are. One thing to say that leads to my second point about protecting these commons is that there are some problems with these licensing systems. The main one being, what happens if you're trying to do something that combines material from under different licenses? I mean, if you want to use something in your mashup that is under a completely free license, and one is a non-commercial license, and one is a commercial, what will happen is the most restrictive license will trump. And and they've had this problem in some scientific endeavors. There was a thing called the HapMap project where they're trying to map the human pieces of the human genome, things called haplotypes. And they started out doing this under a kind of GPL. If you do this, you must sign this license and give it away. But they found that people were having trouble then combining data downstream with more open data sets because the HapMap license had this restriction. So they finally just gave up and said, let's not have any license. And in a sense, there were pieces of the scientific community which already figured this out. What I'm leading up to is, you know, legal systems are one thing, but there are also norm-based systems which can stint the commons, and usefully so. And a good example is what they did in the publicly funded piece of the Human Genome Project. So in 1996, all the labs that were doing the publicly funded piece got together in Bermuda and talked about what they sweetly called the etiquette of sharing. How should we do this? And first they thought maybe they would try to do a kind of GPL system where they would claim and license. But then they thought, you know, actually, we don't. With the human genome, we don't even own it to begin with. We can describe it, but under the tradition of patent law, there's nothing here to own because these are naturally occurring things. So instead, they came up with what they called the Bermuda Principles, which was a set of ground rules for the sharing of human genome data. And the main piece of this, the main element of the Bermuda rules, is that when any lab described a genome up at a certain level of size, it would be released to the world on the internet within 24 hours. That's the rule. And they now do this. And one thing that doing it has enabled is better systems for annotating the human genome. Because sections of the genome that are unannotated are kind of useless for research. But if you know, if you think, well, this has to do with lactose intolerance or something, you can then begin to see patterns and so forth. So there is now a worldwide system, whose name I have here someplace, for annotating the genome. And people send in their data daily, and then every morning, as the sun rises, the distributed annotation system releases their findings on a daily basis, so that every research center in the world has the same data set they're working with every morning. They know what the annotations are and what has been done. So this is a norms-based, this is the way we're going to behave in this community. In certain ways, it's better than a legal base because it allows flexibility as time goes by and as the system itself changes. But it also has social force. I get this from a book by John Sulston, who was the British guy involved in the Genome Project. And he tells one story about the U.S. Department of Energy, under pressure from Congress to work with the private sector, considered offering some of the for-profit sequencing companies exclusive rights to use public data to seek out their genetic drug targets. So, you know, this is the kind of idea that will arise in our Congress. Here we have publicly funded knowledge. Let's give some of it to the privately. But in fact, this fell apart because all the scientists working with it knew the Bermuda protocols. I said, we just can't do this. That's not the way we operate. It won't work. And so the Department of Energy and the Congress had to back off. So whether done by law or by custom, the point of stinting a cultural commons is to assure that the forces of enclosure never deprive the commoners of their use rights. The background fact being that the liberties of comic and encumbered selves are sometimes prior to the free market's purportedly self-reliant individuals. So that's my that's my brief survey of my thoughts on how to have a more durable cultural commons. And let's have some discussion. I'm sure something has occurred to somebody here.
I have a question, an historical question about the founders of monopoly. Clearly they were opposed to monopoly in the English common law sense, the king granting privilege. But my understanding is that the way they sought to combat it was not by doing away with property ownership, making things freer, but simply bestowing more ownership rights on more people. So the corporation was a primary way of doing this, and the founders pioneered the notion that more than one person can have the legal privilege to build a bridge over the Charles River or create a turnpike road. The king can't say only one person can do this. But endemic to that notion is ownership. And endemic to the notion of the corporation is ownership in perpetuity. I'm having trouble turning the corner from this very property-minded notion of combating monopoly to this notion that everything should be free.
You've asked a seminar question. because, of course, I mean, one thing that strikes you when you read the founders is they had no idea what was going to happen by 1830, 1840, 1850. Certainly no idea what was going to happen with corporations and the degree to which corporations were going to take on a different kind of identity.
Right.
And the other thing I'd pester in your, yes, ownership. But ownership is, I think of the commons as a kind of ownership. That if I have common use rights, I have a property right in the thing that I have access to. As opposed to, actually, I set up the book with two different senses of ownership. One is ownership as rights of action. That is, I'm allowed to do this with, I can paint my house green or yellow, because I own it. And the other is ownership as the right to exclude. So this comes out of Blackstone, who says ownership is that sole and despotic dominion which each man's. And I see these as intention, because the right to exclude is a particular form of a right of action. But it also then, if that's your only right, if that's your only sense of property, then you begin to lose these other senses of property that have the more communitarian action side. And I guess I also think, my sense of the founders is that there's a kind of layered ownership business going on in which land ownership is understood to be fee simple
right to exclude kind of ownership. But that above that are, there's an essay on property by Madison in which he says, as a man may be said to have a right to his property, so he has a property in his rights. He has a property in the right of free expression. So this is a property we hold in our commonality, not in our privacy and exclusive way. So beyond that, we'll have to have a long lunch in the back.
First, a point on this previous question. My understanding is that corporations were chartered for a period of time early on, and it was only later in the 19th century that they became in perpetuity, at least in American law. Your cover is Franklin. You've talked about Franklin a little bit, but he seems to me to be an exemplar of exactly what we're talking about. He refused a patent on his stove. He wanted to give that away. He was very clear about the fact that the things that he did, that he was unable to do, was because there was a whole series of people behind him who had made discoveries. And I'm wondering, how deeply did you go into Franklin and his various ideas about copyright and patent? Because he's such a multifarious figure, and it seems that he thought about these things in a very deep way, and I don't think we've caught up with him yet.
Yeah. So I have to. Franklin kind of took me over for a period, as he always does.
He takes everybody over.
Yeah. So I have two chapters on Franklin, and all the things you're saying are true, and there's more to say. I would. I guess two things. Franklin. These guys operated under what I think of as a civic republican ethic, and the civic republican ethic does not turn away from private ownership and private empowerment and individual autonomy. It values that, but then it asks, once you have that, why? To what end have we given you your freelance and your freehold and so forth? And the answer for them was to serve the public good, to do something for your community. And Franklin is precisely that kind of person. So you can say, yeah, Franklin doesn't own his stove and the other things he invents and never takes a copyright, but of course he was rich. He was a successful printer. But it is an example of the civic republican ideal. That is, once he becomes independent enough to quit, he begins to experiment with electricity and so forth and so on. He was not a anti-patent person. There's one letter, there's one case in which some people want to get to the United States, and he says, well, we could give you what's called a patent of importation. That would help you. I mean, he was a pragmatist. But I think in his own life, the circulation of knowledge mattered more to him than ownership. My second chapter is called Franklin Founding Pirate. And just to say quickly, you know, the famous story of Franklin leaving his brother, he was indentured as a printer to his brother in Boston, and he flees to Philadelphia. And in the autobiography, he says he's scared all the way down to Philadelphia that he's going to get captured and sent back because he's a runaway apprentice. He is breaking the law, and the law was that apprentices are being given trade knowledge and they're not supposed to share it. That's one reason they're indentured. It's a foundational act of a piracy, and he should have been locked up if the MPAA had been there.
I may not have followed this, so it may be a very easy question. Other than founding a duty, so to speak, towards the commons in a norm, and I say so to speak because a norm is not a duty, right? Duties, as you say, are the correlate of rights. Is there a foundation for an obligation or a duty to build or maintain a commons other than a norm? And where would that, what would that duty be founded? Because norms are culturally relative. I mean, that's the whole point. The norm could be just about anything. They're usually talked about precisely so you don't have to try to ground them in anything. It's just a norm. It's what we do. Yeah. Is there more to the grounding, either for the founders or for you?
Do you want to add something to this?
Well, because I think I have a related question that I'm having a hard time following. The commons existed to resolve need. And it was an understood need. It was a shared need. That those needs created the norms. And I follow that people working on the human genome have to share information because they need the information.
All right.
What's not clear to me in the other areas, in these other sovereign areas, is where are the needs defined so that you know what a norm would be.
Yeah.
Needs get completely lost.
Yeah.
And that's the piece that I'm having a hard time.
So So one thing I say at the beginning is I think a commons has to nominate the ends to which it is dedicated, the needs it's trying to fulfill. And so what were the needs of agricultural commons? Well, to keep the village in food as the years went by and so forth, and sustain the agriculture and not destroy the field, whatever. One other that's a little less obvious is that some of the rules of agricultural commons had to do with the provisioning of the poor. And you find this in the Magna Carta and the Great Charter of the Forest, that so the right to glean, a right of a widow to have her estivers and so forth are spelled out. So that one might be a little less obvious, that the community was going to care about the poor not starving. But you do need to say what are the ends toward which we're dedicating these things. And in a certain sense, what I've tried to do in this book is to say, well, what were the ends to which the founders thought about the circulation of, you know, why did they value the circulation of knowledge? What were the ends they were trying to actualize? And I end up with three answers, the third one of which will go to David's question. The first one was self-governance, that here they were trying to establish a country in which you would have a citizenry which would be well enough informed to govern themselves. And they felt that for purposes of self-governance, you needed very low barriers to the circulation of knowledge. And that's why you had a commonwealth of knowledge. It's very clear in Adams. You know, I talk about Adams's earliest essay, and Adams wrote the Constitution in the state of Massachusetts, which he called the Commonwealth of Massachusetts, and it's in there. The second one has to do with creative communities, and I do this with Franklin. They thought that if you want to have a scientific community, such as Franklin participated in, again, you need very low barriers to the circulation of knowledge. So that's an end clearly stated, and the commons designed to help perpetuate it. The third one, which goes to David's question, is has to do with what I think of as public beings or collective beings or the social self or something like this. I use a remark from Goethe, the German writer, who says at one point, he's being interviewed, and he says, well, where did my work come from? Who am I? He says, my work has come, you know, from wise people and stupid people and from children and old people and books I've read. And this, and he says, my work belongs to a collective being whose name is Goethe. So he imagines himself as not an individualist creator, but as somebody whose creative abilities are enabled by being a member of a community that treats knowledge and art and history and so forth in this manner. The same is true of Franklin. Franklin's genius, I kind of take on Emerson at one point, because Emerson says, where is the teacher who could have taught Franklin? He was completely unique. Well, it's nuts. I mean, Franklin's genius was the genius of a host, that he had a tremendous absorptive power. I mean, yes, he was a genius, but the genius is the genius of somebody who's enabled to embed himself in a community of knowledge and take from it, you know, absorb it, and do something new with it, but not alone. Even the electrical stuff, he worked with three other guys, and, you know, they worked together. And he couldn't have done it without Newton. He couldn't have done it without German scientific papers that he was able to find. And so these are collective beings. And this, for me, is the other grounding. I mean, to the degree that I could persuade you to feel yourself as not an individual. You know, it turns out the word individual is a modern weird word. There is an older word, individual. And individual means can be divided up. And you find it in anthropology now. People go into villages around the world and they say, we're looking for some individuals to talk to us. And they say, well, we don't have anybody here like that. And they say, well, what do you have? We have people here who think that they come into being because they belong in a family and the community and in nature. And that's how, if you took those away, they would disappear. We'd never heard this thing that was individual. It's very weird. So I could persuade you to stop thinking so much about this weird individuality and think about your individuality. And then I believe that from that follows, I think even norms finally are rooted. I think a norm doesn't work. You're right, the different communities have different norms, but I don't think it works unless at some point you have an intuitive sense that, yeah, this makes sense to me as I perceive myself in this situation. And that I would ground that finally in some sense of what it is to be a human being. So that we can argue for a long time.
At what point did in the case law did it start shifting from this idea of copyright being a common property that you were putting limits on to where it became a right or a piece of property that the person owned? It wasn't even in the commons. If you took it away, you were taking away his property.
I think it's in the mid-19th century, between about 1845 and 1865. And the striking case for me is that there's Foley versus Marsh. It's the first case in which the fair use statute begins to appear, the idea of fair use. But what's really going on is fair use appears because what's happening is copyright is becoming more a commercial right and an abstract right. In the early Republic, your only right was to a verbatim copy of your book. Translations were not covered, abridgments were not covered, and then you begin to get this shift where derivative works, which don't look like the original, are also covered. And that begins to happen in the mid-19th century, and that case was about abridgment. The guy had taken, there was 11 volumes of George Washington's letters and papers. Somebody had made a two-volume set for use in public schools and was sued for copyright infringement. And under the old rule, you would have said, no, in the civic republican ideal, that's allowed because it's not a verbatim copy. It took work to do. It's for the dissemination of knowledge. It's useful in teaching school children. Why would we prevent it? And Justice Story says, well, we'd prevent it because we think maybe the guy lost some money. That's why. And so it begins to happen. But even in, Harriet Beecher Stowe had a copyright suit. There was a German edition of Uncle Tom's Cabin published for German-speaking readers in Philadelphia. And she went after them for infringement. And she lost at the Supreme Court level, the Supreme Court saying, once this is published, it belongs to the commons. Somebody makes a German translation, you can't stop it. Now, that's around 1860. So it's still a little bit in play, but mid-19th century.
You may have to help me formulate what I think is a complicated question. When you talk about this catch and re-release form of protecting common property, it reminds me of land conservation trusts that own land under more odious conditions and then, out of kindness, do a special thing with it. And you talk about normative commons, that, and you even give an example of scientists, social pressure on scientists pushing back against lawmakers and presumably regulators. Can you think of examples or can you invent any sort of political formulation under which those normative protections could become less breachable? The normative connections you talked about in the case of the Genome Project were too complicated to enforce, for example. A reversal of the stifling that's going on. I wandered around the late Soviet Union where the hammer and sickle were the door handles on every building, and the ideological pervasion of every corner blank was extraordinary and stifling. And I'd be interested to hear whether anybody's gone further than just saying, gee, this is a potentially bad situation, what do we do about it?
I don't quite understand, though. So what would be...
Let me help with it. Is there a political solution? Is there a legal solution? Is there some way to reformulate the expectations so that that which isn't specifically taken, passing a test, say, that it's for the good of the public, not only that even corporate profits have to be limited to the good of the public? That's, it's a kind of...
Actually,
60s lefties question.
Yeah. I read a book by Bill Ivey, who used to run the NEA, has a book called Arts, Inc. And one thing Bill suggests in that book is that we should have a sort of cultural environment protection agency or something like this. Because he says what happens is a lot of cultural policy is just made ancillary to other things. So you could say, he gives an example of the way radio stations are governed, and you know, changes in the governance of radio stations, which has tremendous effect on local communities around the country. It's a big cultural change. How do you have the discussion needed before you enact that? Copyright term extension would be another example. Not that you would, you know, be another government agency, but nonetheless, you would be obliged in certain cases to have a public, have somebody write a paper. If we're going to extend copyright by 20 years, what will happen? You know, what are the pros and cons? What is the cultural impact of this? And but beyond that, I don't, I mean, this is what a lot of us are struggling with. I actually think that the Copyright Term Extension Act was a bit of a watershed. The fact that, that Lessig and others got it all the way to the Supreme Court, it makes, you know, the discussion has now, and the internet, the problems that that are so common now to people trying to figure out how to make the internet work, means that it's going to be harder next time to just run something through the Congress with $5 donations. but it might help to institutionalize.
Have you seen any evidence that there's are political strains heading that way?
Well, I mean, what poor Larry Lessig has done is to leave the copyright realm and try to change capitalism. So, good luck to him.
I mean, Congress has been going in exactly the opposite direction. Everything is automatically copyright, whether you, I mean, you have to work to put it in the public domain.
Yeah.
Second of all, we can just take it out of the public domain because of one, you know, one rich constituent. So who cares that tens or hundreds of thousands of, you know, works go out? I mean, it doesn't seem like there's any solution except what Larry's doing. That seems like the only hope.
Sometimes I feel this, sometimes I feel more hope.
You know, one big example for me, since I'm not in a university, I'm not signed up to get the papers, is the average citizen or user on the internet can't get professors' papers without paying. And I wonder, you know, why is that, and should they be the first to change things?
But that's changing. I mean, in the academy, you know, the open access movement is really... So at Harvard, they have now change those rules that, that professors are supposed to post their papers for open access. You know, they can opt out of the system, but the default is you post your papers. Sometimes there's a 6-month delay or something like this, but there is a movement to change that. And that would be another example, actually, of trying to create a lively commons and have some norms in place that encourage, you know, get the tenure and promotion committees to recognize that open access publishing is as worthy as not.
One more question?
Yeah, one more question.
What are you thinking about the site-specific cultural commons, like particularly the ones in the Gulf region that are all in danger of collapsing post the BP spill? How would those sort of specific communities actually apply a cultural commons framework around cultural survival?
And so, say more about a site-specific cultural commons in the...
So the, like, 141 families on the Bayou and Slidell, where there's a very specific cultural commons around a way of life connected to that land and that language and that... Yeah, the Vietnamese community further towards Mississippi, fishermen. But so you have these really specific cultural commons that are based around a way of life that are having to make tough decisions now. And I'm wondering what, how does the cultural commons framework that you've supplied here create any sort of scaffolding with which to try to make some kind of legal or normative?
I mean, you know, in the end, you know, the kind of thing I do, I write books. I believe that it's useful to have well-articulated explanations of how these things work out there. After that, you need organizers. You need people who are both trying to help people understand what their actual interests are and how the system works, and get them to operate in their own best interest. And so we're back into American politics, in which, you know, there's a fog of misinformation out there, and you know, one has to assume that some of these people on these bayous voted some of the people into office who were against regulation and were signing off on the BP permits without reading them. So, you know, those are citizens who don't have access to the knowledge they need to be active citizens. So go back to the organizing.
Thank you very
much. All right. Thank you.
Now I understand you have a book coming out.
Yes.
who are you quoting about